This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
Assalamu alaikum. A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajeem. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Thanks very much for inviting me to speak here. Those are a lot of specific things you wanted me to talk about. I think I'll try. So basically this talk, I wrote it on my phone while I was pushing my kids to the park. It's probably not the most responsible parenting. It's a very important topic. People think about it a lot. And I wanted to kind of just run through what are some of the areas of where this issue appears, these areas of law this issue appears, and talk about kind of what Muslims' obligations are. First thing to keep in mind is that Muslims are required to follow the commands of the ruler. In Arabic, it's sultan, or hakim, or imam. I hate using the word state because it's sort of state worship, and I feel like Muslims use this as an easy way to get out of any kind of problems. They say, "Oh, the state will do this, state will." I don't like that word, but it's, the Arabic word is sultan or imam. The sultan, the authority, the ruling authority. So that Muslims are required to obey the ruling authority, provided the ruling authority doesn't command them to do something that's against God's will. And that's true whether the ruling authority is Muslim or non-Muslim. Right? The Quran says, obey God and obey the Prophet and those in authority amongst you, ulul amr minkum. And we know that's a command. But then the Prophet restricts this and reminds us in a hadith in Sahih Bukhari and other collections that innama ta'atu fil ma'ruf, obedience is only in what is known to be right. And this is then absorbed into a principle in Islamic law, a qaida that, or a dabita that, la ta'at li makhluq fi ma'siyat al-khaliq. You cannot obey a created being if it disobeys God, the Creator. Obviously, if someone has got a gun to your head and says, you know, drink this beer, you can drink the beer. But I mean, in general. So this is just a principle, regardless of whether you're Muslim living in, you know, 8th century, in the 800s in Baghdad, or in Egypt today, or in America today, is that you are obliged to obey the ruler or the authority, provided that it doesn't require you to do something that disobeys God. Well, what happens if the ruler commands you to do something that's against the Sharia? I want to get into some details there, but let's just say just generally, what happens, for example, what happens if the government says you need to drink wine every day at dinner? This is a legal requirement to drink wine every day at dinner, and you need to bow down and kiss the feet of this idol, or you need to feed your children pork. By the way, this is not a theoretical issue. In the early 1500s, after the Granada was conquered in 1492, and all Muslims were forced to convert in 1525, by the way, other parts of Andalusia had been under Christian control since the 1085. So you have Muslims living under Christian rule since the late 1000s in Spain, what's now Spain. But the point is, in the early 1500s, the Kingdom of Aragon and Castile, the Christian kingdoms that had conquered all the Iberian Peninsula, actually forced existing Muslim communities to drink alcohol, to eat pork, to go to... And so some of those communities wrote to scholars in North Africa, one of them the famous Maliki scholar Alwan Sharisi, who died 1508, common era, and they said, what should we do? The answer that Alwan Sharisi gives, which has been the main answer that Muslim scholars consider authoritative since then, is you have to emigrate, you have to leave. If you're living in a place where you are not allowed to practice your religion and you are forced to do things that God prohibited clearly, you have to emigrate. You have to leave. Now, another answer was given by another mufti who died in 1511. He was also from North Africa. A scholar named Al-Wahrani from Wahran. And his response was, no, you hate these things in your heart. You know that's haram, but you have to stay and you have to do this because otherwise there won't be any Muslims there, period. And the benefit of preserving the Muslim community there, even if it's in secret, is so great that it justifies your disobeying God. That's the minority answer. But I think, you know, when we think about, alhamdulillah, in America, we don't really have this problem yet. But hopefully we won't have it, period. But, I mean, if you're, let's say you're in a European country, in the Netherlands, part of a citizenship, in order to get citizenship, you have to view certain pornographic images. You can look this up. Go look it up. Somebody look it up. Just so that you don't believe I'm making this up. On from not fake news website, okay? So you have to, and you have to make statements about your views on homosexuality and on sexual liberties. So there are countries in, and I'm not just talking about countries like France which prohibit the niqab in public or something. I'm talking about countries that actually require Muslims to engage in actions that are prohibited clearly in their religion, at least one time. Okay? So this is, I think this is a time to think about what should Muslims do in these situations? Should they leave? Or is there an inherent value, something valuable about staying in that place, even if you're forced to do things that are haram? We have both choices in our tradition. Okay. How do we know when I said, you know, you have to obey the authority as long as it doesn't require you to do something that violates God's command? What do we know how do we know what God's command is here? Okay, Dr. Jamal talked about the Sharia. The Sharia is there's no book of Sharia. You can't go find a book that says this is the Sharia. Sharia is the idea of God's law. The idea of God's law. Its actual manifestation in human life, as Dr. Jamal talked about, is fiqh. It's human effort to understand what God wants from us. Now, some of those things are clearer than others. For example, we know that zina is prohibited. We know that drinking wine is prohibited. We know that stealing is prohibited. But then when you come to things, let's say like issues of dress, are men required to have beards or not? Are men required to wear hats or not? Are women required to wear to cover their face or not? These things are disagreed on by Muslim scholars. So let's say a government says, we prohibit the niqab. Your school of law, let's say you're a Hanbali or majority opinion in the Hanafi school, you might think, that no, you're a woman, as a woman, are required to cover your face when you go out in public. But there's other totally accepted schools of law in Islam, in Sunni Islam, that say you're not required to. So here we have, you're really in a situation where you can take advantage of the principle of al-hajatu tanzila manzila tadrura amatan kana al-khasa. So that need takes the place of necessity. And necessity, darura, makes permissible what is prohibited. That's why if a guy has a gun to my head and says, I want you to drink this entire 2-liter bottle of whiskey, well, that'll probably kill me, but that 2-liter bottle of beer, I can do that because that's necessity. If you have a situation where you are systematically under certain pressures, you can't do things that are prohibited, but you can take advantage of existing flexibilities within the fiqh tradition. So here, start eating pork regularly, but you can, if you're a woman, stop wearing the niqab and showing your face. You can, if you're a man, shave your beard and not have a beard. So there is flexibility in the Sharia tradition about what are the limits for what God's law is. What exactly is God's law in a situation? And if the rule is saying, let's say, women can't wear niqab, well, Muslims can still stay there because it's not required to wear niqab in the even in the majority schools of law. Okay. By the way, Muslim states also have the right to do this. A Muslim ruler has the right to select either rulers within a school of law or between schools of law, raf'an lil-ikhtilaf, in order to remove. And I was trying to think of an example of this. The only one I could think of is in the late 1000s in Baghdad, in Seljuk era Baghdad, there's this really prominent, notable comes to town, and he's a Hanafi, and they're following, no, he's a Shafi, but they're following the place where he's going, they're following Hanafi rules of fasting, when you break fast and stuff like this. And so there gets to be a conflict over, should they listen to him and his opinion on when you break fast, or the other people who are following the Hanafi school? And it goes all the way up to the ruler, and he basically says, just take the Hanafi ruling. This can't be a disagreement. We need to know, somebody needs to decide when we're going to break our fast and how we're going to follow the rules of fasting. So this is the right of the ruler to do this. Now, if you're a Muslim minority living in a non-Muslim country, Muslims individually or Muslim communities have that right with certain constraints. There's different opinions about this. The majority, middle-of-the-road opinion on the issue of what's called takhayyur, or choosing between different options, is you can choose between different schools of law either if you feel the evidence is better for one school of law or the other, the evidence for the Quran and the Sunnah, or if some kind of pressing need or necessity requires it. So, you know, let's say my neighborhood is all full of people walking their dogs all the time. Their dogs are coming out to me. They're sniffing my legs. They're licking my pants. This is my neighbors actually do this. One of my neighbors, in fact, brings his dog all the way up to my office door to pee there for some reason. And he does it with such confidence. I'm like, is this actually okay? Or is this seem? Should I go and tell him this is wrong? Anyway, this is not a big issue. The point is, if you have a situation where it's really hard for you to avoid having a dog coming and slobbering on you at some point, then you can say, I'm going to take the Maliki ruling and say that the dog's saliva is not najis. Because otherwise, you're constantly going to be changing your pants in order to pray. So that's one restriction. The second major restriction is you can't come up with what I call Franken fatwa. You know Frankenstein? You can't have the Franken fatwa, where you have, you know, okay, the dog came and licked my pants, but I'm going to take the Maliki ruling, so I'm going to go pray in my pants. And then, my hair's looking really good today, so I don't want to mess with it too much when I do wudu, so I'm just going to wipe the front of my head. I'm going to take the Shafi ruling. I'm just going to wipe the front of my head, not my whole head, which is the Maliki ruling. Maliki says you have to wipe your whole head. And then you go and you say, I don't want to make a lot of sound when I pray, so I'm not going to say Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim as part of the surah when I'm reading the Quran. So now you have, you're then licked by a dog, wiped only part of your head. So it's not acceptable in the Shafi school or the Maliki school. And then the Shafis require you to say Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim out loud as part of the prayer, if it's an out loud prayer. So my point is that you end up with a Franken fatwa, where none of the schools of law that you've actually are relying on would accept the final composite result. That's Franken fatwa. So you can't have the Franken fatwa, but you can mix and match based on needs, legitimate needs. Okay. Now, there's something else that I want to bring up, and I actually have more time than I thought, which is that we have to be very careful that you don't allow what you perceive as pressing needs to lead you into laziness. What do I mean here? If a lot of Muslims in this country, Arabs, a lot of Muslims in this country don't care about halal meat. They say, meat of the people of the book. A lot of Muslims in this country do care a lot about this. Desis. Okay? If all Muslims had said, we're only going to eat halal meat, then Muslims would have gone into the butchery business, and it would be terrible for those Muslims stuck out in some village or some town with no halal meat, and they would have to eat fish for a couple of years or not any meat. But in the end, Muslims would start their own meat industry, and maybe they would even come to dominate the meat industry. But if you constantly are taking licenses taking rulings that allow you not to do something, then allow you to do something in this case, then you're not forced to create the religious infrastructure that your community needs. So this is something you want to watch out for. We want to watch out for. In areas of criminal law, a lot of times this is what people mean when they talk about Sharia law in America. Oh, Muslims want to start chopping people's hands off and things like that. Look, even in a Muslim country, even in Baghdad in 1000s or Delhi in 1400 or something like that, it is not up to Muslim citizens ever to engage in criminal application of criminal law. This was, and you can find this all the way back to the time of Imam Shafi, very explicitly saying this. This is the job of the wali al-amr. This is the job of the ruler to do. A person, let's say if my brother gets killed, I bring the case to the judge, and I say, this guy killed my brother. But it's the judge who orders the execution, oversees execution, and carries out most of the time the execution, if I want to have the guy executed. Okay. Well, that's not even an issue. What about what we would call civil law, or basically things like contracts and property and things like that? Here, first of all, there's a lot of the Sharia is the same as American law. I mean, there's only so many ways to deal with someone breaking a contract. You know, either they have to pay you money or they have to do what they said they were going to do. It's not that difficult. And when there's things like riba or gharar, namely unacceptable risk or interest, we can have contracts that say we're not going to use interest. And that's what Muslim finance, Islamic finance organizations do. We can debate about Islamic finance to wear the blue in the face, but the point is it's well within our capacity and our rights in this country to have contracts with each other or with other people that don't use interest or unacceptable risk. Another really controversial thing is family law issues. But again, in the United States so far, we've been granted a lot of flexibility on this. So, for example, two states, there's cases in two states, both Florida and New Jersey, have already cases in the 1980s and 1990s where family law courts have upheld the marriage contract of Muslims as binding legal contract and forced the husband to pay the back-end mahar, the mu'akhar mahar, to a wife that he divorced. Two states have not done that. Maryland. But in one case in California, it was because they just didn't consider this to be a contract. In the case of Maryland, this is interesting, and this is where the kind of controversial issue comes up. They considered it to be against public policy. This was a case where a Pakistani man had gotten married to a woman in Pakistan, and decades ago they'd moved to the U.S. The guy had made a lot of money. They'd become U.S. citizens, and the husband divorced the wife. And he basically said, "Okay, all I owe is, back when the 1960s we got married in Pakistan, my mahar was like $500. All I owe you is $500, and here's my contract to prove that." The Maryland court said, "No, this is unacceptable. This woman has been your wife for decades. She's sat and cooked your food and done all this stuff, and she's a citizen of this country, and there's no way we're going to let you treat her like this." That's the kind of issue where you might see contradiction between, quote-unquote, the Sharia. I don't really think that's very good Sharia law in this case either. The Sharia and American law is when people start seeing marriage agreements as unconscionable or socially unacceptable. But this is an interesting thing to keep in mind, and this is why I think Muslims are held to a double standard, or held to an unfair standard. If I'm some super celebrity rich person, and I want to get married to someone, and I make them sign a prenup saying, "You're not going to get a single dime of my massive celebrity wad of cash if I divorce you," that's fine. That's a fine prenuptial agreement in the United States. As long as it's not unconscionable. And this is well within the realm of the conscionable in American law. That's fine. But if a Muslim had done that, then it would become, "Oh, look at this, unacceptable, horrible Sharia law." If I want to have my will that says my law, my money, my estate will be distributed according to the Holy School of Law, someone can come and say, "Dick, in your school of law, the daughter only gets half the money of the son. This is unfair." And in fact, about 2 years ago in the UK, when the UK Bar Association was handing out guidelines to help attorneys there do client wills, they got in trouble and they had to retract that advice because they said people in the press were saying the Sharia is systematically oppressive to women in terms of their access to or the rights they get under inheritance. But if those people had just been rich white guys, they would easily have, I can have in my will in the United States and the UK, I can say, "I want to leave all my money to Rush Limbaugh's radio show." Okay? And I don't like my kids, so they're not going to get a single thing from me. Or I want to leave all my money to my son because he's male and I like men. And I'm not going to leave any money to my daughter because I don't like women. That would be fine. But the fact that in the Sharia, the daughter gets half the inheritance of the son, then this is considered to be oppressive. So you see in this area of law that even when there's an idea that Islamic law is so against social policy in the United States or unfair, the same exact practices, if they're carried out by a non-Muslim, are fine. Now, I say things could change. I hope they don't, because in 23 state houses so far, 23 states in this country have had laws proposed, either proposed or passed, to ban the use of foreign laws, which they mean the Sharia. Now, in one case in Oklahoma, the federal court there overturned the law as unconstitutional. That's because it specifically talked about the Sharia. And then the group that was leading this, it's all based on this guy David Yerushalmi's template for these laws. They went back and said, instead of saying Sharia law, they said foreign laws. But everyone knows what it means. And by the way, I'm sure if there's some Japanese company that says, we have a Japanese, we're going to go to Japanese law on our contracts, I'm sure that some state of California is not going to not allow that contract, even though it's foreign law. Here, they really mean Sharia law, and they really mean it for marriage, and they really mean it for inheritance. And the danger is that this tide of Islamophobia in this country will lead people not to protect the legal rights of Muslims. And if you live in a state, one of these states that says basically that Sharia law is prohibited, what does that mean? What does that mean? If you live in Tennessee, for example, where one of these laws has passed, in theory, you could be arrested for fasting. In theory, my will would not be valid because I say divide up my estate according to the Hanbali school of law. In theory, my marriage is not valid. At least my certain aspects of my religious marriage are not valid. And in this case, Muslims need to ask themselves, should Muslims live in these states, like Tennessee or something, or not? My own take is this is an issue being disputed. This is an issue that people are fighting over now. And if Muslims just say, you know, I'm not going to live here because the Sharia is not allowed, I'm going to follow Juan Charisi's fatwa and move to, you know, New York or something, you're just going to give up on the fight. And the fight is not anywhere near over. And so Muslims need to be present for this, and they need to make their voices heard, need to make alliances with other groups that are protect the rights of religious minorities to live according to their laws in those areas where this is permitted by our legal system. Jazakumullah khair. Assalamu alaikum. I only got a few questions. So one person asked about different schools of law say different things. Can you just take it? Are all opinions equal? No, they're not. I mean, you're talking about the four Sunni schools. You know, these are all well-argued traditions. I mean, I think those are all equally considered. I mean, within a school of law, you might have some what's called shadh. Shadh means irregular, anomalous opinions. And then some scholars come up with, like, say, Mufti comes up with called shadh ruling. So that's what people should really watch out for. Not necessarily, you know, the main madhhab position on something, but, you know, one mufti or one scholar from the 1100s or from the 1800s giving one fatwa, and then you take that. Because then you get a lot of what's called shad fatwas, where if you took those, you could really create the ultimate Franken fatwa, you know, the version of Islam where you'd be, you know, fornicating, drinking, dancing, opening a bar, whatever, all at the same time, and have some kind of justification. Because you have 1,400 years of tradition, you know, countless thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of scholars, and every once in a while one of them comes up with a really bad ruling. And if you just go hunt that out and find it, you'll be able to justify what you're doing, which is not appropriate. Should you stick with one madhab? My opinion, yes. I mean, certainly in the United States, yes, I think you should stick with one for basic things like how you pray, rules for fasting, rules for zakat, things like that. But I think it'd be very difficult to live in the United States and to be part of Muslim life, public life, and only follow one madhab. I think pretty soon you're going to start having to be more flexible on specific issues about public life. You know, what time Jummah prayer is, for example. Mosques in the United States take advantage of the Hanbali ruling where you can have Jummah prayer even before the beginning of Dhuhr time. And a lot of people would say you can't even have more than one Dhuhr prayer. Or, you know, you could be Hanafi and say you're in Dar al-Harb, so no one's praying Jummah at all. That would be a very bad way to have a community. Not that I have anything against Hanafis otherwise. My point is that you can have one madhab in your private religious life, but I think once you get into public organization, it's going to be very hard to do things like organize Eid prayers, organize Jummah prayers, organize anything without having some kind of mixing and matching for purposes of facilitation. And then finally, the last question was, how do you explain the punishment for homosexuality according to Sharia law? Well, the punishment is either, depending on the school's law, either it's for liwat, for sodomy, the punishment would be death, or in the Hanafi school, the opinion of Abu Hanifa would be that it's up to the ruler, to the judge, to decide what the punishment is, but it's not a death penalty. Why is that? I'll just look historically, not from a Muslim perspective, just historical perspective. So when human beings started settling down in agricultural communities, 4000 BC, 5000 BC, we have some of the earliest law codes we have, at least preserved, or any records of them, codes like the Code of Hammurabi, Assyrian law, the laws of Eshnu, things like that from 3000 BC, 2500 BC in Mesopotamia. One of the things that you often find is prohibitions on homosexuality, especially for men, and side by side with prohibitions on bestiality. So you can see this in the book of Leviticus in the Old Testament, where you have prohibition on homosexuality and prohibition on bestiality right next to each other. Not the act, the prohibitions right next to each other. Okay, that was a pretty good joke. Nobody got it. But anyway, why is this the case? If you think about, human beings, human beings are animals. In Islam, that's what we are. We're hayawan. We're hayawan natiq. We are animals that reason. Now, one of the first things human beings have to do is say, especially if you're living with cows and camels and sheep and all sorts of other animals all around you, you have to ask yourself the question, what are the lines we're going to draw? Human beings have to draw lines between themselves and, time is over, thanks, between themselves and other species. And then the second thing they have to do is they have to draw the major line within the human community, which is the difference between men and women. And so these laws actually create these very early distinctions between human beings and non-human animals, and then within the human species between the genders. So that's, I think, how you explain why these laws exist historically in human civilization.
Jazakumullah khairan, Dr. Brown and Dr. Jamal, for your time and for your valuable advice and clarification. Jazakumullah.